Johann Weisthoven is the educational values of Chancellor Curtin, and this lecture is based mainly on his private letters and public speeches. A recent report on Nashville Public Radio observed that graduating high school seniors should make choices based on who they are. They should choose a college that fits their interests instead of trying so hard to get into an Ivy League school for the sake of credentialing themselves. Interestingly, this NPR ideal of making choices based on who you are is something that Chancellor Curtin of Vanderbilt University, who served from 1893 to 1937, already promoted as early as in the 1890s. How ironic, then, that universities located in the South tend to be omitted from the history of American higher education. I would like to argue that by including Kirtland and Vanderbilt in the picture, we gain surprising insights not just about higher education in the South, but across the United States. Make choices based on who you are. Kirtland himself is an important case in point. The ideals he promoted were the ideals that he tried to live. His approaches to education as a teacher and administrator reflect the private man. But the whole is more than an adding up of individual parts. As he observed as a young professor at Vanderbilt around 1890 in a lecture on Antigone, in studying her, there are two ways open to us. One, to consider the elements of her character dissected and apart. Another, and it seems to me a better way, is to bring Antigone herself before us, that we may see her act, hear her speak, and feel her presence and person. This is about, there is something about every character, no, I'm sorry, there is about every character an aroma as incapable of accurate analysis as the perfume of a flower, but just as plainly perceptible. While today the Vanderbilt campus is much of a monument to Kirtland's activities, we know little of the man, his thoughts and ideals. Kirtland was described a practical idealist. A reference to the interconnectedness and possibly tension between his ideals and his activities. Kirtland once observed that the most practical thing in the world is a new idea in a man's head, fresh inspiration to his heart. Let us now look at the ideas in his head and in his heart, starting with his most private moments, his letters to his wife, Mary Henderson. What sort of relationship did they have? What does their marriage say about Kirtland's priorities in life? And what about his gardening? I will then proceed to his ideas about educating their only child, Elizabeth. This will eventually allow me to reflect on his educational concepts as expressed in his public speeches in light of the insights gleaned from the private documents. Jim met Mary Henderson, a native of Knoxville, in early 1895 in Nashville. A first letter survives from February 1895. They got married on November the 20th of that year, when Kirtland was 36 years old and in his third year as Chancellor of Vanderbilt. Their relationship is well documented in the countless letters they exchanged over the years until shortly before his death in 1939. Indeed, he was often traveling on university business while she would also absent herself on a regular basis. These letters reveal Kirtland to be a devoted family man and a lover of nature who liked to retreat to the mountains. He also loved to go hunting and fishing, but best of all, he liked to retreat to his garden. Kirtland worked very hard and for long hours, and not infrequently did the university encroach on his private life. However, He always found the time to drop Mary a line when they were separated. The relationship between Jim and Mary was based on mutual understanding and respect, mixed with some teasing, as is evident in a letter Mary sent in June 1895. "Don't you know that you were very bad to disobey me? I see that I have not got you under good control," and she added, "yet." In one of the earliest letters to Jim, Mary asked, "Is your pride hurt that I do not stand more in awe of the Chancellor?" Jim as well displayed a dry sense of humor at times, such one as during their courtship he wrote, "I forgot to tell you that I heard Frank Stanton read some of his own poems. I suppose I forgot to speak of this because the mint juleps made so much deeper impression on me." But he immediately turned back into a lover, longing for her to recite a poem to him. Already the earliest letters give proof of their deep mutual understanding. Mary wrote in March of 1895, "It is very strange, but it seems to me that you have been my friend for a long time, and that I can say to you just what I think and feel, and I'm not awed by the formality of first acquaintance." To which Kirkland replied, "I am so glad that you feel free to say to me all that you think or feel. Friendships are not to be measured by years, but by sympathies. In my opinion, one of the most delightful experiences of life is when two persons stumble on each other by accident, as we have done, and find that they are not strangers, but in thought, feeling, interests, and sympathies are close akin." As he became more self-confident in the course of their budding romance, he confided that he had been a little shy at first, "for it did not occur to me that a young lady who was moving in the social swim could take any interest in my life or manner of thinking, or find in my company anything but a momentary diversion." Social swim is a key word, for Kirkland was the more secluded of the two. Mary managed to combine both qualities, an appreciation for the deeper thought, as well as of lighter social intercourse. By contrast, Jim explained to Mary, "Isn't it a pity that our intercourse in social life has to be so entirely on the surface? How tired I grow of tossing compliments to and from, of listening patiently to stories you would gladly run from, and smiling with consummate grace and stupidity at the recital of trivial nonsense. A chat with you, Mary, is worth an age of such emptiness." The fact that Mary seemed more at ease in social circles also provided Kirkland with opportunities for joking jealousy, such as when from Dallas, Texas, where he had run into a few Vanderbilt boys, he wrote in April 1906, "Much regret has been expressed that you, Mary, did not come too. Next time I shall stay with Elizabeth and send you to represent the university." It shows how little he actually enjoyed his official and representative duties. But Jim could rely on Mary supporting his work, such one as he learned that a member of the Vanderbilt family was on a hunting trip near Memphis in 1903. "I shall wire him today, inviting him to visit us before going back," he informed Mary. "If I get an answer that he will come, I may phone you, for we would like to give him a lunch." He moved on to express his regrets for possibly having to call his wife home, stating that it will be your luck to have him come while you are away. Mary also occasionally mediated between him and Vanderbilt faculty when he was out of town. Kirkland appreciated his wife's autonomy. In early July 1895, they must have been talking about marriage seriously. Mary informed him, I have always done exactly as I pleased, and any kind of constraint would stifle me. But this was less radical a statement than it seems, for she went on to scribble, I would want to feel that I could be perfectly independent about cards and invite whoever I pleased to our home. She clearly stayed in the private sphere, as was the fitting late Victorian style. Still, Kirkland's response reveals how much she valued both their personal freedom. Your individual conduct in all matters that concern you as an individual will always have to be determined by your own judgment. In these matters, each must stand alone. Experience has taught me that I must have some regard to the consciences and even prejudices of others. As to the future, I ask no pledges of you, as I give none with reference to my own conduct. This is a key passage to a better understanding of Kirkland the person. He lived the philosophy of live and let live. He was willing to give what he expected to receive, whereby he acknowledged certain limitations, such as differences of opinion. One thing that Kirkland did expect to have was a garden. It is common knowledge that he was a devoted gardener who cultivated iris. His biographer, Edmund Lynch, noted that, like the hero of Voltaire's Candide, Kirkland would, after many vexations and disillusionments, cultivate his garden. But that is not the entire story. Various images of gardens played an important role in Kirkland's life, from his childhood days in the 1860s until shortly before his death in 1939. In his childhood, the garden was a necessity. When he was courting Mary, it became a romantic ideal. The garden served as a metaphor for their enjoying each other's company without outside intruders. In May of 1895, Jim told Mary, I appreciate as opportunity so much your kindness in slipping off from the gay circle in the parlor in order to talk with me. To be sure, they could not possibly appreciate your presence in the parlor as much as I did your coming once more in our garden. This garden was not a real garden. It was the idea of their having found each other. Mary played with the image as well. In mid-June of 1895, as they were planning a trip to the mountains together, she wrote, that garden seems very transportable, don't you think so? We will be there the 1st of August, won't we? Will I go? Indeed, I will if you go too. Kirkland built a home with a wife that must have been reminiscent of his childhood home. The new home with Mary soon became a reality, including a real garden. During the 1920s and 1930s, references to cultivating his garden took up more and more space in Kirkland's letters, much more than in the early days when he often talked about university business. He realized an ideal in the course of his life, that is the ideal of his private garden, meaning private happiness and seclusion. As the virtual garden was transformed into a real garden, it was not merely filled with pretty flowers. Instead, it was, quite pragmatically, filled with cabbage, cantaloupe, and potatoes to supplement the Kirkland's diets and even to make a little profit. In the early days, they owned cows and actually sold milk, though Kirkland sometimes refused to accept money from the Vanderbilt faculty.
Sometimes.
Jim discussed garden work almost in one breath with office work, as for example in a letter probably from the 1920s. I'm ready to plant second crop potatoes as soon as it rains. I'm getting my office work straightened out. This mixing of garden work with university business is a mixing of manual labor with more intellectual types of labor. It can be traced back to his childhood. His sister Sue remembered how they would read novels to each other while milking their mother's cows. The garden had a strong appeal, almost stronger than some aspects of university work, particularly the representative aspects. Kirkland wrote from West Point, Mississippi, "I don't enjoy knocking around strangers. Had much rather stay at home and look after my garden and cows." However, the cow Bernie died and left a little calf. He fretted, "I have bad luck with my cows." Fortunately for us, he was more successful with his university work. Still, the garden was the epitome of the private sphere. He confessed to Mary, "I hate to have strangers come into my garden." The garden meant rejuvenation, health, and happiness. As he once wrote to his grown-up daughter, Elizabeth, on the way home, "Tomorrow morning, I hope to find my garden full of blossoms and a few vegetables ready for the table. I'm wondering if, after all, it would not be best for you, Elizabeth, to come home, too." He also forwarded the flavor of his garden to his family when they were away from home by sending some flowers from our garden. These will, of course, all be wilted, but they will leave some fragrance in the box, and Elizabeth can have the pleasure of tearing them to pieces. The garden was home. Kirkland wanted Elizabeth eventually to have one on her own, especially since she had joined him in his garden since her early childhood. Indeed, already in 1902, Jim had told his 5-year-old girl that, "We shall have to begin to make you a garden, I think." While a student at Wellesley College in the late 19-teens, Elizabeth was an enthusiastic gardener herself, as we can see in a letter that Jim sent her, "While you are planting potatoes, I'm fighting the bugs on mine. My roses are in bloom now. We are eating from the garden mustard, spinach, onions, peas, and strawberries. It has been rainy and the weeds are growing apace. I certainly need some help now. Wish I had a squad of Wellesley workers for a few days." When Elizabeth had a family on her own and was approaching middle age, Kirkland informed her, "I shall be glad to have any further reports of your garden." The garden also stands at the end of his life. In one of his last letters in June 1939, Kirkland told Elizabeth that he had sold his Irish garden. The money was put into a special bank account at Mary's disposal in case Jim got seriously ill, though some of it was for Jimmy, his oldest grandson, who apparently shared his mother's and grandfather's love for gardening. This pragmatic turning the garden ideal into money served two aims: to put Kirkland metaphorically at rest in his garden, and also to get his grandson Jimmy started with a garden of his own, and thus to get him started in life. Of course, Kirkland was not only interested in getting his daughter started with the garden, he also put much thinking into educating her. Ironically, he was ambiguous about women's education. While he left Mary much room to lead her own life, he was less enthusiastic about co-eds at Vanderbilt. In 1902, he mused, "We are matriculating students rapidly. I don't see so many girls about as last year, and of this, I'm very sorry," adding a "not," thus stating that he was not sorry to see so few women on campus. Then again, his daughter was born in February 1897. Unfortunately, sources are too scarce to give a definite opinion whether Kirkland changed his mind about women's higher education once his own girl had reached college age. Nonetheless, Kirkland's letters give us insights into how he raised Elizabeth. In an undated letter, possibly from 1918, he advised Mary regarding their daughter, "I am hopeful that she will be honest with herself and not hide her real purposes, even from herself. My deep conviction is that Elizabeth should work either in serious preparation at a school or in some job for immediate pay, if she can find one. But if she's not to work, then let her come home. I fear, however, that Elizabeth has another program. For Kirkland, it was important in the first place to know what one wanted and to be true to oneself about personal motives. He promoted the ideal of a focused, hardworking individual, which indeed is a fitting description of him. In this particular letter, he also realized that Elizabeth would do as she pleased, implying that he had no intention of enforcing his will. It is ironic that Kirkland wanted Elizabeth to find out what she wanted, knowing that if she did so, it might be contrary to what he, as a father, would favor. Interestingly, already in his opening address at Vanderbilt in the fall of 1897, half a year after his daughter's birth, he had briefly referred to ideal family life, disagreeing with the notion that correct family life is that where the will of the parent is impressed on the child and becomes the law of the child's action. Instead, he thought that there must be some better way than the multiplication of rules and regulations. This other way was faith. Chancellor of a Methodist school at the time, Kirkland certainly referred to faith in Christianity, which, however, also meant to have faith in ourselves, in our friends, in our surroundings. Faith is a conquering force. Confidence is power. It is hardly surprising then that he did not wish to impose his will on his child. He wanted her to have faith in herself, in which case he would support her decisions. Kirkland also emphatically advised his daughter to measure her strength and not to exhaust herself. This hints at the practical aspect of his thinking. Faith alone won't save you unless you use your life, time, and strength wisely. This insight may possibly be explained by the fact that he himself, after earning a PhD degree in Germany, had succumbed to typhoid fever. He lost almost the entire final year of his 3 years stay in Europe in the 1880s, recovering his health. The infected leg troubled him again 50 years later, reminding him of the exhaustion he had experienced in his youth. Another letter to his daughter is revealing. He wrote it in 1926, shortly before Elizabeth departed with her newborn son, Jimmy, and her husband, Ben Merritt, a Greek scholar, for Athens, Greece, where Merritt was to conduct research for 2 years at the American School of Classical Studies. Kirkland's advice to his 29-year-old daughter is educational. She was to read for her own good and explore the foreign nation. This trip will mean much for Ben, but it has less return and more sacrifice for you. Your life for the two past years has been a steady grind. In Athens, you will have an opportunity to widen your outlook and extend your acquaintance with men and things. This will be good for your mind and body. Mother and I will be more willing to pay whatever sum is needed to furnish you personal relief from domestic duties wherever such relief is possible. Look after Jimmy, of course, but give yourself time for reading and study and helpful contact with the larger world. While the letter displays concern with Elizabeth's intellectual development, Jim added ambiguity as to his view of educated women. Then, in a follow-up letter, he suggested that she explore the culinary side of Greece. Having expressed his satisfaction with her advances in Greek, he continued, "If your cook will permit it, you ought to practice some of those foreign dishes. You could make a great hit when you return home by giving a Sunday night supper serving foreign food." hinted already that Kirkland's attitudes towards educating his daughter reflected attitudes he proclaimed as an educator and administrator. Let us now take a closer look at Kirkland in the actual classroom. As a young professor at Vanderbilt around 1890, Kirkland observed that instruction must be given not from textbooks, but from the heart and mind of the instructor. Hence, he searched for a balance between the intellectual and the emotional side of his being, albeit that the emotional side outweighed the intellectual side. Just as the garden had more appeal than traveling on university business. He continued, "Truth must be dispensed, not from the printed page held in the hand, but from the burning soul as part and parcel of its own being." This ideal of a fiery teacher was not merely a theoretical consideration. He himself was an excellent teacher. In educating his daughter, he had put the emphasis on being true to oneself in the choices one made in life. As a teacher, he started from the same premise, arguing that true teachers found teaching in themselves. Rather than an acquired skill, it was a personal quality essential to interest and instruct students effectively. Kirkland's attitude resembled the one of his own teacher, friend, and colleague, Charles Foster Smith at Wofford College and later at Vanderbilt. Kirkland's admiration for Smith, the scholar and teacher, is apparent in a letter to Smith from 1919. "It was a turning point in my life when I came in contact with you after your return from Germany. With you, my college course would have had no scholarly inspiration. I should have left college and gone into some other business or profession. Certainly, I should never have gone into teaching." For both men, teaching and scholarship formed an ideal unit that was of much greater value than earthly riches. As Smith observed, "Scholars are God's anointed, and happy are young men who come under the influence of these. And what are the rewards of such scholars? Not generally large in money values, but something better." Kirkland wanted to impart this ideal to the next generations. He passed on in his public speeches what he himself had learned as a student. For instance, when he observed in an address at the University of Virginia in 1922, "The supreme achievement of education depends not on an intricate organization of even efficient administration, but it does depend on the presence of great personalities in the classroom. Every teacher's chair is radiant with possible influence. Eager students elect teachers rather than subjects." Just as the good teacher was born to teach, each person would find strength in herself, particularly if she had a great teacher. Kirkland summarized his views, "It is therefore this inner life that determines the outer. As a man thinketh in his heart, so he is. This is true in a sense not intended by the poet, for it is the dream of the schoolboy or the schoolgirl that fashions the life of the man or woman." In spite of such idealism, Kirkland was rather pragmatic as a chancellor. In 1902, for example, he skipped Woodrow Wilson's inauguration as president of Princeton University, explaining to his wife, "They don't seem to be making much of an occasion of it, so I guess I shall not go. It is rather far to go for one public meeting." He preferred to stay near his garden, leaving only when a trip seemed absolutely necessary and promised a good payoff. Still, Kirkland strove for the top with regard to his university, Vanderbilt. he acknowledged that great diversity was needed in the American educational landscape, characterizing the American college as something different from a trade school or a professional school, or even from a university. But there is no doubt that his ambition was to mold Vanderbilt into a great American university. A 1904 letter to his wife reflects the thrill he felt about opportunities that would allow him to do so. "The greatest need of the South is a great university. And Wallace Buttrick of the General Education Board asked me whether I thought Vanderbilt could be liberalized enough to make that the foundation to build on. If we can get our affairs in shape in the board and get the Peabody College, no telling whereunto we may yet grow. That would be great, would it not?" Of course, the cooperation with Buttrick and others would turn out very fortunate for Vanderbilt, resulting in cutting the ties with Methodism in 1914 and the substantial reorganization of the medical school in the 1920s. Kirtland thus realized his educational visions just as he had brought his private garden to fruition and continued to do so. During the 1920s, Kirtland repeatedly elaborated on his vision of college life, which gives us insights into his vision of great education. Kirtland's college life rested on three pillars: an intellectual basis, a social tendency, and a spiritual outlook. They reflected his belief in educational diversity, but also in Vanderbilt as a tough institution. The intellectual basis made it the first duty to restrict our numbers to the intellectual life of those who are most worthy, particularly as there is not room in our colleges for all applicants. He explained, "There are other roads that can be traveled by those who cannot stand the old and windy heights of intellectual effort. Colleges fulfill a specific purpose in society. Not everyone was ready for them. Admission policy should raise standards by selecting those who were best suited for the institution. While this might seem restrictive, it may actually be interpreted as an argument in favor of helping young persons to find the most fulfilling career. The social component in college education was rooted in Kirtland's conviction that no man really lives who does not live for others. Having found oneself, a person should turn to aiding others, just as Kirtland devoted a lot of energy to the university in spite of the garden. Kirtland observed, "The individual student is a member of a larger group. He learns quickly to recognize himself as responsible to his fraternity, to his class, and to the whole university. He learns to regulate all his conduct by these large units, and as he moves along his college course, his world gradually enlarges until he develops a real social conscience that admits responsibility as wide as human need. To build his own character properly, he must help to build a world. This building of a world, in turn, would allow the students, through his studies, to enter into the larger life of the world. To achieve this, the world, the whole life and surroundings should be educative. Campus, trees, and flowers, cities, concerts, lectures, sermons." Thus, a virtual garden sneaked into Kirtland's rhetoric as he sought to describe his ideal college. Today, the Vanderbilt campus is, in fact, a garden, a well-groomed national arboretum. Extracurricular activities, as well as the different subjects that students chose in college, were to teach about the present. History is not a study of the past any longer. It is a study of the vital forces that control the present. The modern languages open up contact with other nations and other civilizations. Education, consequently, was a process that shaped the whole person in preparation for a real purpose in the outer world. Spirituality was the final test of college work. It referred to the college, to the role of the college in influencing and molding character. It was not enough to acquire knowledge and social skills. We ask still more of the college man. He must be a seeker after truth, and he must have developed a soul that responds to the highest appeals made to his higher nature. Not the amassing of knowledge, but the process of doing so mattered. For what we take to be fact today is tomorrow proven to be falsehood. Men have studied false theories of science for thousands of years, and we are no doubt studying them today. The educational processes in all past ages have, however, been the great uplifting influences of human life. No, not facts, but an ongoing search for truth was the purpose of college life, which, of course, should help the student find his calling and mold his character to do good. Kirkland remained consistent in his approach to education. In 1936, he declared that the few meager facts that can be brought together concerning Shakespeare are not worth a day's effort unless our study moves on from these things to a better appreciation of the wonderful works that Shakespeare has left us. Four decades had passed since his reflections on Antigone, which I cited in the beginning, regarding a holistic understanding and appreciation of human character. In a 1936 address, Kirkland observed, quoting Montaigne, "I speak truth not so much as I would, but so much as I dare, and I dare more as I grow older." But his speeches of the 1920s and 1930s reflect very much the young chancellor in his private letters and early opening addresses at Vanderbilt. Still, while some of his ideas, such as the realizing of one's wishes, may sound idealistic, he was well aware of limitations to his philosophy. In an undated letter to his wife, he grumbled, "This is a hard world, and human nature is very weak. No wonder I'm sometimes cynical." Yet only once, out of hundreds of letters, did he send a truly gloomy one. It probably dates from the late 19-teens or early 1920s. He wrote, "Life seems to me much of a failure. I look back at my ideals, what I wanted to be, what I meant to be to you, and I have missed it all so far. But I will try. Maybe some relief will come. If I could only be different." Kirkland had acknowledged that dark moments were part of life as early as during an opening address in 1897. It is true that we all have our moments of doubt when we question the truth of almost every proposition we ever acceded to. But the light is the sweeter for some hours of darkness, and faith may stand the stronger at last. With hindsight, Kirkland's life was far from being a failure, but truly to appreciate his efforts, it is not enough to add up all that he accomplished during his administration. Rather, one must try to bring to life the man with all of his curious quirks. In this way, as I hope to have shown today, we can understand more fully that many of Kirkland's educational values were, in fact, very much ahead of his times. Take the idea of being true to yourself. Chancellor Kirkland of Vanderbilt defied categories that were established in the history of American higher education, a history that has omitted the South. By adding Kirkland and Vanderbilt to the picture, we acknowledge that institutions of higher learning that are located below the Mason-Dixon line for a long time have made significant contributions to American higher education. Thank you very much.
We have time for a few questions, if there are any, about the deep, dark secrets of Chancellor Kirkland.
I have a question. I've heard, or read some of the books on Vanderbilt history, and one of the things that's interesting is that Kirkland was a very spiritual man, in the sense of, if you go to West End Methodist, there's a plaque, right, when you walk in for him. What role did religion play in his life, and then sort of before, and then after the split?
Well, first of all, he came from a very strong Methodist background. Some of the letters between his parents show that they were very much into Methodism. And while he was abroad during his student days in the 1880s, he would regularly go to churches, to an American church abroad, but also to German churches to practice his German. And that is also a hint. Yes, he was a Methodist, but he was also very pragmatic about that. So he personally didn't break with Methodism, but he thought that to make a university great, to get the money, which basically had to come from the North at the time, it could not be a denominational college. So his severing the ties with Methodism, which was a 10-year struggle that ended in 1914, really was part of his scheme to make Vanderbilt great. Because Carnegie Foundation, they wanted to have schools that were not denominational, and then they would support them. Then again, I was surprised when I read his letters, in contrast to the letters that his parents exchanged during their courtship. He does not speak a lot about church. It is more of a, oh, it's Sunday, and yes, I go to the sermon, but you do, or to the service, but you do actually find letters where he says, well, it is very hot today. It's Sunday, I guess I stay at home. So that happened too. So I would say he had a very healthy relationship with his religious background, and he would practice it, but he would not have it rule his life. And in his professional life, he would just really be very pragmatic and act in the best interest of Vanderbilt, or what he thought to be the best interest of Vanderbilt.
I would just add to that comment that the chancellor was very much a Methodist and solicited from the Methodist Church on three separate occasions support for Vanderbilt University. Before deciding to approach Northern Philanthropy. And all three of those solicitations were abject failures by any measure. Most of the money came from Vanderbilt faculty from the Chancellor's pocket. And I think, as religious as he was, he realized that if Vanderbilt were to ever have money, it had to go to a different source. And so he had to turn from the Methodist Church for the very practical reason that there were no resources.
That is why he eventually won that lawsuit and that broke the ties with Methodism, because his argument was, okay, so Methodists chartered this university in the beginning, but they never really gave a lot of money. And to make this a great school, we need money. And if we don't get it from the Methodist Church, I have to find other sources. So thank you for this comment.
How much time did he spend in Germany? And are there particular characteristics that you think became evident in him from that experience?
Mm-hmm. He spent 3 years in Germany, or let's say 3 years in Europe, from the summer of 1883 until May 1886. He spent 2 years in Germany, 3 years in Leipzig, earning three semesters in Leipzig, earning a PhD degree, one semester in Berlin. And then he went to Geneva. He wanted to study French and travel a bit, but he got ill in Geneva. He came down with typhoid fever, and it took him 4 months to recover, and then it still took him more time to really regain all his strength. And so he basically lost that year. Although, and here come in some characteristics that I think really are telling about him. He just rearranged his schedule and planned a new course of studies for this past year when he was very ill. I was really struck reading his numerous letters from Europe that he planned ahead very carefully. His letters to his mother, every other week he sent his mother a letter, he always wrote, okay, I'm doing this now, and by the end of the semester I will have accomplished this or that, and then I will move on to do this or that. And usually he really, when he says, I finished reading this particular author at this time, he did, and then he moved on. So he is very focused, he is very well organized, and very well structured. And when he lays sick in Geneva, he's of course very annoyed about losing so much time. But after a few weeks, as he gets stronger again and as he recovers his health, he just makes new plans. He says, okay, so I won't be able to study in Paris, so I'll just forget about this. What I think I can do, I can travel in Italy. This will not exhaust me too much. This will not be too strenuous. So I think this is what he learned, or what we can learn from his German experience or European experience, is really that he was just excellent planning things, organizing it and economizing with his time and with the resources that he had. And I think these are qualities that that really served him later as a chancellor of Vandenberg.
I just want to go back to Chancellor Kirkland's views of women and higher education. It seemed like he had a lot of women that influenced him, like his wife and his daughter. Do you have any idea why he still hinted that he wasn't concerned that not a lot of women were at Vandenberg?
Yeah. Well, I guess this is one of the complexities. As he himself said, as a teacher in studying Antigone and so forth, it's not easy to really understand the man. And I find numerous contradictions about him. I think to some extent he is at this point also kind of very much representative maybe for the time in which he lived. At that time, even though in the United States women had a lot of opportunities to study at colleges and universities, the initial or original idea of a university or college, even in America and also in Europe, was to educate men. And so in the late 19th century, this changes dramatically. At that time, and here comes Victorian America that I taught, life is really very much organized into two spheres. The public sphere, that's where men like Kirkland, or where men work, and the private sphere. But this doesn't mean the private sphere for the women, that they just are there and just cook and just don't do anything else. They just have all these social activities. They might have discussion circles, and Mary Anderson Kirkland, she would bring together wives of faculty members and organize a lot of things. So I think this is just a transitional period where he has to acknowledge that women now also, through all their social activities in the private sphere, they are basically entering the public sphere, and that life is changing as to that. Yes, and I also noticed that in the 1920s, and he also gives a number of speeches at women's colleges, and then he makes an effort to really say, well, education for the young man and woman. So I think, again, the pragmatic side, that he really tries to acknowledge that. But unfortunately, I really would have been interested in that question to find out more. He does not say anything about, in his letters, about what he thinks about educating his daughter. Apparently, he really supported her in her decisions, but I don't know to what extent this changed his views. Let's just say that he is a little contradictory, and that in the end, he will accept, the woman decides to study, he will accept that, and his soul is open to change, I think. Yes.
44 years is a very long time to be chancellor, a president of the university. Mm-hmm. You look through a lot of his correspondence from other sources. I'm wondering, what does he think about his own longevity and success? And also, one of the letters you mentioned, what things might he, did he consider also doing, or maybe that he might have been disappointed in not being able to do? It's a long time.
Yeah, it's a very long time. And he started out as a very young man for a chancellor, for such a position, which was kind of unusual. I think until about the 1920s, when, of course, Vanderbilt Medical School was one of his greatest achievements that we remember today, he was really very much into it, I can say that. And the 1920s for him still were a period where, when he was really at the height, one could say that, even though he was already in his 60s. What we can see is this period from 1904 until 1914, this struggle with the Methodist Church, that was a very difficult period for him, and he seriously, repeatedly considered leaving Vanderbilt. And he had offers from other universities to become president at other universities, usually in the South. So you can really see he had his ups and downs, but of course the success in 1940 is a new starting point. And then he gets into all these connections with Buttrick, whom I mentioned. I didn't go into that. But all the contacts with the Northern philanthropists that really kick off in the 19-teens, and the result is the 1920s. By the end of the 1920s, I think he's getting tired. And then he already in the early 1930s, he tries to resign. But at this point, Vanderbilt faculty and students and alumni think, Vanderbilt without Kirkland? Can that be after 40 years or so? So it is not until 1937 that he actually retires, and then soon thereafter he dies. So, but what I thought also in the letters to his wife, you notice that there's more and more garden, and their vacations grow longer, and which of course is also good. I mean, have a time out, you're more powerful when you come back. But you can really see that. In the beginning, of course, the young chancellor, who is barely 40, around 1900, he's very worried of doing all these things and being very busy all the time. But in the 1920s and 30s, it's all like, and I went to my garden again. Yeah, other questions?
Well, please join me in thanking our speaker once more for...